The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Susan Dellinger from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from Oprah Magazine, February 2019, Volume 20, Number 2. And this is the second installment for February. Oprah is very casual on this month's cover. She's wearing gray suede pants and a blush pink sweatshirt with the word "Share" written on the front. Her hair is a mass of highlighted shoulder-length curls. This month's headline is a quote from Oprah. Every person has a story with the power to crack you wide open. And let's look at the behind the scenes for this cover shoot. Share the love. It's what the world needs, and Oprah's leading the way. At this month's cover shoot, Oprah must have been inspired by the word "share" on her comfy sweatshirt because she was clearly in the mood to open up. First, she busted out some dance moves to Drake's "In My Feelings." Then she got downright personal when the conversation turned to relationships and how to keep the sparks flying. Oprah's favorite way to spice things up? Oprah says, making Stedman cornbread with jalapenos always does the trick. There's a picture of Oprah in the middle, a snapshot from the shoot, and we are seeing this from behind the lights. So there's the white background, and we're seeing the backs of the utilitarian photo shoot lights, and Oprah got her hands up, and the caption reads, "Peace, Love, World created Oprah's cozy and uplifting top for the shoot, and now you can own one too. $62 at peaceloveworld.com. And then other ways to get your instant messages. These personalized pieces really let you use your words, and there are three of them here. The first is a well-worn and washed-looking Levi's classic denim jacket for $98. It's been embroidered, and we're looking at the back of it, and it has the word "share" embroidered in script in yellow, below that in orange, and below that in kind of a deep red. Monogram, embroider, or add buttons and studs. You've got tons of options. And the jacket's $98 with customization beginning at $25, and go to levi.com. Now, the second of the three is a maroon V-necked cashmere sweater. It's $400 and it is available at linguafrance.nyc. And it has had the word "share" again in script embroidered in white at the bottom of the V-neck. Words can be hand-stitched on a crew or V-neck sweater. And then the third option is this kind of deep sort of forest green, almost like a varsity sweater. It's a crew neck form-fitting sweater from Ralph Lauren collection, and it has two wide white stripes on the upper arm of the left sleeve, and it says "share" in those kind of varsity block letters. Pick your color combo and graphics to make it one of a kind. They're $198 and go to ralphlauren.com. Then we have a picture of Oprah here, and she's sharing a pre-lipstick laugh with makeup artist Derek Rutledge. So she's sitting at the makeup mirror in her specs and a big grin on her face, and Derek's leaning over getting ready to put some lipstick on her. And now let's look at the message, here we go, from Oprah, her introductory message for the month. And she's standing at an oven, a wall oven, and she's holding this great big heart-shaped cake, a red cake inside a red heart-shaped cake pan. She's wearing washed jeans with a sort of lilac V-neck sweater over kind of a salmony pink top. The sweater is over the other top, really bright and colorful. Oprah says, "Love is in the air, as they say. I'm all for a holiday devoted to telling our special someones how much they mean to us. A sweet gift doesn't hurt either, and I feel confident that this month's O-List can help. But if you're still looking for that special someone, or just curious to know what it's like in the dating world these days, check out our guide to searching for love online later in the magazine. Of course, romantic love isn't the only kind worth celebrating and sharing. There's the love of a great read, for example. If you've ever been in a book club, you know it can be invigorating for your mind and social life. But later in the magazine, you'll discover what else a book club can do. Keep doctors attuned to those they care for, help people who say they're too busy to read, and strengthen our connection to the world and each other as we get older. Come February 14th, I hope you find yourself with a worthy Valentine, whether that's a person, a good book, or maybe best of all, a person to share a good book with. Hugs and kisses, Oprah." So let's head over to the reading room and look at 10 titles to pick up now. And the first one is House of Stone by Novaya Rosa Shuma. An exuberant, diabolical fiction debut set against Zimbabwe's birth and early years, when a teenage son goes missing, his stricken parents enlist Zumani, their obsequious lodger, to track down the boy. But there's a problem. Zumani may not want him to be found. The second title is Mouthful of Birds by Samantha Schweblin. An ethereal adolescent shocks her father when she devours sparrows, bones and all. A half-crazed man stabs his wife and stuffs her corpse into a suitcase. The author of the magnetic, scalp-prickling Fever Dream returns with stories as gothic and incantatory as a telltale heart, virtuoso fiction from Argentina's own Edgar Allan Poe. The third title is Hark by Sam Lipsight. The lauded satirist's caustic send-up centers on a cobble of hucksters, among them a hapless husband whose marriage is, quote, locked in low-key Catodian apocalypse, end of quote. Working to turn a phony self-help guru into a money-making messiah, every line feels as thrillingly charged as a live wire. The fourth title is Elsie Come Home by Susan Conley. Mommy likes beer and green alcohol. Mommy doesn't like the chokeholds of marriage and motherhood. In this intricate, delicate as rice paper novel, an American painter living in Beijing and trying to clean up her act at a yoga retreat makes gains in fits and starts. Quote, a butterfly flitting from leaf to leaf, end of quote. The fifth title is Shameless by Nadia Bowles Weber. In this frank and funny mix of memoir and religious scholarship, a former stand-up comic and Lutheran pastor preaches a more eros-positive approach to Christian ethics, quote, based not on a standardized list of thou shalt nots, but on concern for each other's flourishing, end of quote. The sixth title of the 10 titles to pick up now is The Heartbeat of Wounded Knee by David Truer. The 1890 massacre of some 150 Lakota Sioux was a turning point in our country's blood-soaked history. In a marvel of research and storytelling, an Ojibwe writer traces the dawning of a new resistance movement born of deep pride and a reverence for tradition. Truer's chronicle of rebellion and resilience is a manifesto and rallying cry. The seventh title is The Water Cure by Sophie McIntosh. Cloistered on an otherwise uninhabited island, three sisters help their parents resuscitate women envenomed by the mainland's literary toxic misogyny. When a group of men shipwreck upon their shore, things really get complicated. The eighth title is You Know You Want This by Kristen Rupinian. It's no mean feat to write a work of short fiction that goes viral, which the author managed with her zeitgeist-nailing New Yorker story, Cat Person. This transgressive collection of tell-it-like-it-is tales, brilliantly dissecting our darkest yearnings, proves that Rupinian is no one-hit wonder. The ninth title is Adele by Lila Slimani. From the French provocateur behind The Perfect Nanny comes a feminasty thriller about a married journalist whose unquenchable thirst for sex threatens to upend her seemingly idyllic family life. And the final and tenth title of titles to pick up now is Oculus by Sally Wynne Mayo. Mayo's kaleidoscopic verse scrutinizes our obsession with on-screen spectacles and includes a tour-de-force sequence that imagines silent film actress Anna May Wong time-traveling to star in Breakfast at Tiffany's and 16 Candles. Quote, cast me as that girl who rivets center stage, or cast me away, end of quote. And now let's go to the special feature section of this month's magazine. We have a close-up shot of the heart-shaped candies, and we're all looking forward to those in just about a week. You know, the ones that say kiss me, love, etc. Well, we've got green and blue and pink and purple and orange, and the pink one in the very middle has a darker pink Oprah O on it. February 2019. Know what we heart? Books. Know what we heart even more? Reading books in the company of others, and the talking, the learning, and the growing that comes with it. We turn the page, and we have a group of, well, about 10 women, all decked out in costume as if they might be in a Jane Austen novel. And they're not pretty young ingenues. They're all middle-aged and older women, looking quite something in what are apparently homemade costumes. Quite charming. Book clubs that made a difference. Sure, they foster friendships and a certain amount of wine consumption, but book clubs also increase our compassion, strengthen our connection to the world around us, and maybe even keep us in shape. Join us as we explore a fellowship that can be profound beyond words. The group that reads together succeeds together in broadening their minds, deepening their humanity, and supporting each other when it really counts. It is a lovely thing to be a reader. It's even lovelier to be a reader among readers. I've devoured books since I was a kid, and many have changed my views. And this is from Mary Laura Philpott. But it's what happens after I read that's changed my life. The talk I have with a person I've lent a book to, whose connection to it tells me something about who they are. The kinship with other readers who loved the story, and the delight of occupying its world with them. Little wonder, then, that I leave my book club's meetings feeling like I've been plugged into a power outlet, my mind humming with energy and ideas, and my now fuller heart just as a buzz. I'd dropped out of three book clubs before this. There was the one where I hated all the books, the one where I loved the books but hated that nobody actually talked about them, the one where I showed up late to my first meeting and received passive-aggressive emails from its president forever after, and then I found the Loose Women. 5 years ago, I reunited with an old pal who invited me to join the club she'd started after an infatuation with Bridget Jones' Diary. I knew none of the other 20 or so women, but soon realized they took books seriously. Loose women swap paperbacks over lunch, go en masse to readings, and meet monthly without fail. Hosts make dinner or just tell everyone to head to the bar. The first rule is no pressure. Keep it loose. Why? What do you think the name meant? Once A member showed us the book she'd bought to explain sex to her daughter. Several loose women swiftly bought copies of It's So Amazing to arm themselves for the talk. Codependent No More has made so many rounds, we don't know who has our communal copy. But our closeness isn't all about the books. When you've lived through love, loss, pain, rage, death, grief, and impossible joy with a steadfast group of sympathetic souls, no matter that the drama happened only on the page, you are bound together. So in good times and bad, we lean on each other. We lend outfits for wedding, show up for funerals, godparent one another's children. I believe we have our book club to thank. When we talk about characters, we debate what we do in their shoes, and in this way, we may actually, quantifiably, be increasing our empathy. What are relationships built on, if not empathy? Reading, sharing reading, seems to prime our brain for friendship, for tolerance, for understanding. How often in life do we get the chance to respectfully disagree, let alone do so over a cheese plate, and then cheerfully say, "That was fun. See you next month." If you're reading this, you may well belong to a book club yourself. If you don't, I hope you will soon. It may take a try or two, but don't give up. If you keep looking, you'll find your people. Follow them into imagined worlds and stick by them in this one as well. Who knows the plot twists that might ensue? Mary Laura Philpott is the author of the forthcoming essay collection, I Miss You When I Blink. The next contribution is from Lynn Marcus, Modesto, California. And this one is entitled Austin Found, One Club's Giddy Decade-Long Ride on the Jane Train. In 2007, my husband and I were driving to Santa Cruz, California for our 30th anniversary. We planned to go on the roller coaster there 30 times when I opened his gift. It was a novel, Austenland, by Shannon Hale, which he bought after seeing me watch dozens of Jane Austen adaptations over the years. I loved the book, which is about an Austen obsessive, and yacked about it and lent it to friends who loved it too. We met up to discuss it, talking about our own admiration of Jane, tea parties, movies starring handsome British men. That's when we realized we actually knew nothing about Jane Austen. We'd read at most Pride and Prejudice. We took an online quiz about her works and failed miserably. We were illiterate, but plucky. So we formed a book club around her novels, calling it Becoming Jane Austen. We also bought Jane Austen for Dummies to be thorough. To start, we chose Emma at random. Little did we know, it's challenging and not well loved, but we stuck it out, then methodically moved through the oeuvre. Persuasion is our favorite. Mansfield Park took some rereading, but we came around. We all grew into huge Austen fans for real this time. And then we finished. Austen wrote only 6 major works, but we were enjoying ourselves too much to stop, so we pressed on with other classics written before 1920. The Hunchback of Notre Dame, among our most divisive. Frankenstein, wonderful. We discussed it on Halloween. Jane Eyre, we adored it. Who doesn't? Rebecca, a rule bender since it was published in 1938. The Scarlet Pimpernel. 3 people showed up for this, and only one really liked it. We keep things lively, for, far from the madding crowd, we had an English country picnic worthy of a magazine shoot. For David Copperfield, somebody costumed herself as Miss Betsy and chased everyone around with a broom. Since the very beginning, we've frequently dressed up. Once we all sat and made Regency-era bonnets, which we now wear to every meeting. Who cares if they're not the right headgear for a room with a view? Didn't grab us. Once you're a Jane, you're always a Jane. And there's a picture here of Lynn, and she's wearing what really might be a contemporary navy blue top with kind of a scoop neck, but what she's put with it makes it very Jane Austen. She has some ivory lace gloves and some ivory lace that she's just sort of like a scarf that she's tucked around her neck and wrapped around her neck and tucked in the top, the scoop neckline. And then this Regency era bonnet is in ivory, so it's got that bow that frames the face, and then it has ruffled lace inside the brim. Excuse me, it's the brim that frames the face. And then it has this navy blue satin ribbon that's tied in a big bow under her chin. And her hair has all these curls that are coming out of the bonnet. And next up, from Guinevere de la Mer in San Francisco, her contribution is entitled Silent Partners. This book clubs philosophy, more chapters, less chat. It all started with my adorable nightmare of a baby who almost never slept. There was no hope of relaxing at home. I had to remove myself from the house to get a break. I live in San Francisco, and two blocks down my street is a French restaurant called Bistro Central Park. Four blocks down was my friend Laura Glahanich. Occasionally, I would leave my husband with our son and flee to the bistro and Laura to talk about books we were reading, or rather, not reading. I was in a book club, and I'd bitch about my inability to finish the books. I'd been a reader all my life, and that part of my identity had been taken over by motherhood. I told Laura, I want a book club where there's no assigned reading, and you don't have to talk or be insightful, and you can just drink wine and quietly read. She said, I love this idea. Let's do it. So that year, 2012, we started a book club of two, meeting up every few weeks, bringing whatever book we wanted. We mentioned it to friends. That sounds amazing, they'd say. Can I come? We'd say, sure. They'd bring friends, and their friends would bring friends, too. Soon we couldn't fit in the bistro. We had to relocate to a bar with couches and later the opulent lobby of the Palace Hotel. We called ourselves Silent Book Club and unofficially Introvert Happy Hour. When one member moved to Brooklyn, we started a chapter there. We decided to encourage more people to start chapters, posting on Facebook and Meetup, and now there are SBCs all over. A London group meets in a park. One chapter is sober, so they gather in an ice cream shop. Another in Ohio meets only at fast food restaurants. People sometimes ask me, why would I leave my house to read? I say, sometimes you want to share the same space with like-minded people, to be in the world, but carving out time for you. And of course, it's not totally silent. The first half hour of the two-hour meetup, most people do talk about books. That can lead to a lot. I still run the San Francisco chapter at a bookstore in Haight-Ashbury, and one woman has been coming for years, first with her boyfriend, whom she then married, and now they're expecting, and she's become a good friend. Those connections are wonderful, almost as wonderful as finding a way to make reading a non-negotiable part of your life. And from the Oprah staff member Katie Arnold Ratliff, we have Pages for the Ages. A group of elder book lovers reads, remembers, and riles each other up. Today's schedule at Atria on Roslyn Harbor, a Tony retirement home on Long Island, includes a silver sneakers class, a showing of Cider House Rules, a xylophonist performance, and in the living room beside a flickering fireplace, Atria's wildly popular book club. Writer Linda Aaron hosts book groups in retirement communities around New York, including Atria's. Her oldest member at Atria Hudson is 102. Most here are in their 70s and 80s. Before the meeting, a woman sidles her walker up to Aaron and says, "What's the next pick? Can't we read something happy?" Aaron smiles, then addresses the group of two dozen as they settle into armchairs and nibble on cookies. She says, good literature is conflict-driven. Today's picked, Jeanette Wall's The Glass Castle, is a memoir of a childhood marred by poverty and alcoholism. Aaron asks, What was one of the main emotions Jeanette lived with? Herb, the soul man and group contrarian, whose subsequent defense of Walt's alcoholic father is met with eye rolls, says shame. A slight woman with a pixie haircut finds the book a bit over the top. She says, I feel it's embellished. They went to the zoo, and the father let her play with a cheetah? I can't see a father or a mother doing that. Aaron says, well, have you ever met a father or a mother like this? The woman thinks, then admits she hasn't. The group spends a while exploring the nature of memory. A woman in polyester slacks says, talk to the widows here, and everyone had the best husband. Please, nobody had a bastard for a husband. People romanticize. Herb says, I was a good husband. By now, one member's eyes have closed and others seem lost in a reverie. For some, the point of these meetings is proximity, to listen to the patter, be pleasantly near others. But if you are fired up about the material, the Cheeto doubter says, I took a memoir course and everybody had weird things. Has nobody who had a normal childhood written a memoir? Aaron says, what's a normal childhood? That earns several nods. And Aaron goes on to say, we've talked about this. How everybody gets stuff to deal with in a lifetime. Has anyone here had an easy ride straight through? In this warm room where everyone knows everyone and all share a desire to remain tethered to the world, the club members shake their silver heads no. And now next, let's look at the book club called Second Opinions. Doctors, nurses, and hospital staff find a novel way to relate to patients. Read books about what it's like to be one. The fifth floor conference room at New York City's Tisch Hospital is blandly sleek. Its huge windows look onto another blandly sleek building across First Avenue. The air conditioner drones. The table seats 20, and every periwinkle-hued chair is filled, as are those lining the whiteboard-clad wall, which features a massive digital clock. Here, time is everything. Spend it well, and you might save a life. Spend it poorly, rush a medical history, overlook a symptom, and you might damage, even end, that life. And so today, 32 doctors, nurses, administrators, social workers, chaplains, PR strategists, and other staff have assembled to be reminded of the crux of their work, the people whose fates are in their hands. The Patient Experience Book Club reads about humans with ailments of all kinds, physical, psychological, situational. The group has read Being Mortal, a treatise on end-of-life care by surgeon author Atul Gawande, M.D., the Margaret Edson play Wit about a woman with terminal ovarian cancer, and the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel Tinkers by Paul Harding about a man on his deathbed. Every discussion includes typical book group preoccupations, plot points and twists, characters loved or loathed, but returns ultimately to the book's lessons about how best to care for people. The focus of their discussion now is Hillbilly Elegy, J.D. Vance's memoir of a hardscrabble youth in the Rust Belt, and, to many pundits, a peek into the worldview of America's white working class. So far, the group's conversation has covered class anxiety and the dying American dream. Now it circles back as ever to health care. The affliction from which the protagonist and his family suffer is a familiar one. Poverty. This reminds me of what we see all the time, says the group's moderator and founder, Catherine Hochman, M.D., a lab-coated ball of energy with a wedge of unruly hair, who serves as the hospital's associate chair for quality of care. Catherine goes on to say, social determinants of health, right? How do you help a homeless person who comes in repeatedly? Get him a home. Then he stops coming back because he can care for himself. A blazer-wearing administrator says, you can give all the medical assistance you want, but if you're not addressing the underlying problems, she trails off, her point made. Right, says a chief of emergency medicine visiting from Brooklyn whose cell phone has been urgently pinging. But the question is, what's the role of the healthcare system in doing that? Getting people legal assistance? Food assistance? Hochman says, social workers, I'm looking at you. One social worker at the table, a woman in a floral jacket, says firmly, those basics are healthcare. The woman in the blazer begins to sound off against the perennial and disproved complaint that some people cheat social services, taking advantage of the government's free ride. Hochman reels the discussion back in, returning it from the political to the personal. And Hochman asks, how has this book changed people's understanding? Can we apply anything from this to our patients, who admittedly are not from Kentucky and Ohio? A soft-spoken woman wearing a purple NYU lanyard speaks up and says, even though the author went to Yale, there are still instances where he reverts back to his upbringing. If we get a sense of where patients come from, it can help us meet them where they are. Then an internist who'd arrived late says, everything they bring with them is important in the presentation of the illness. It's important to always understand their social factors. And Hochman adds, really taking a great social history and not judging. The internist, nodding, says, listening to what they're saying and also not saying. A young woman sitting at the edge of the room, silent up to this point, crystallizes the conversation's most salient takeaway. She says, you don't know someone's story until you let them tell you. Now the giant clock reads 1 o'clock, and it's time for everyone to return to labs and rounds, dosages, and bottom lines. At this hospital, as at any hospital, patients' needs are sometimes overshadowed by the sheer volume of work, the pressure for precision that all staff face every day. But thanks to a few dozen dedicated readers, today might be a little different. And the next contribution is called Talk Radio, listening in on a book club for those without sight. The radio show Speaking Volumes opens with several bars of plinky bossa nova, followed by the smiling voice of Carol Serafcon. If you're joining us for the first time, welcome. If you're one of our regular members, welcome back. Maybe you listen as you eat dinner or take a bath. The show airs at 8 p.m. the first Tuesday of the month, prime time for dining and unwinding. Or maybe you listen after taking your guide dog for a walk. Speaking Volumes is a book club intended for a specific audience, people who are visually impaired. The show is produced by Audio Journal, a Worcester, Massachusetts organization whose volunteers help keep visually impaired listeners abreast of current events by reading local and national news, magazines, and descriptions of cultural happenings on the radio. But its broader mission is to prevent isolation in this community, which is where the book club comes in. By choosing titles recorded as audiobooks and announcing them far in advance, the group ensures that everyone can follow the discussion. As Audio Journal director Vince Lombardi, no relation to the football legend, explains, of the nearly 5,000 people who are legally blind in central Massachusetts, most were born with sight and lost it through aging, injury, or disease. He says, a good percentage were heavy readers, and many had been in book clubs. That was taken from them. You can imagine how that would feel. Recently, Audio Journal volunteers, Serafcon plus five fellow bibliophiles, broadcast their discussion of David Grand's true crime powerhouse, Killers of the Flower Moon. There were appreciative comments about its quick pace and historical rigor, and the audience remained top of mind throughout, with descriptions of the book's photos and evaluations of the audiobook's male and female narrators. Once future selections were announced, The Chalk Man by C.J. Tudor, the Tom Wolfe throwback, The Bonfire of the Vanities, Jasmine Ward's powerful Sing, Unburied Sing, the bossa nova started up again, signaling the end. But perhaps for a few new listeners out there in Radioland, it was just the beginning. And there's a picture here of another book club, and we have about a half a dozen women holding books, walking on one of those walking paths that's inside a building on sort of a balcony. And it says these books were made for walking. Reading can do a body good. On Wednesdays, the Walking Book Club of Elgin, Illinois, circles the rec center track, or when it's warm, strolls along the Fox River and discusses the week's pages. As one member says, you can't exactly get in shape by walking once a month. So the group divides every book into four parts and tackles one per week. The approach adds a bit of suspense as members vie to predict plot twists. Thus the big rule, no reading ahead, even if it means asking a spouse to hide the more gripping page turners. And now we have a two-page spread of a big picture, and we have a diver underwater diving down to what are a circle of sculptures. Where are you going? Alicia Ward, photographer. Diving deep in Grenada's Mulmier Bay underwater sculpture park. When I was a kid growing up on Hilton Head Island in South Carolina, my parents loved to rent little pontoon boats, and sometimes bottlenose dolphins would shimmy right up to us, trilling and squeaking. That was the beginning of my fascination with the ocean. It only intensified after we moved to Hawaii when I was 13. A couple of years later, I started working on a tour boat. Now I travel the world with my husband, who shares my passions, doing aquatic photography and taking small groups of tourists out on a 28-foot boat for what we call educational safaris on the ocean, so they can see dolphins, whales, and turtles in their natural habitats. I sometimes can't believe the things I've witnessed. On one trip, a whale caught a mahi-mahi in front of us, tore it in half, gave some to its calf, then carried the rest of it in its teeth and dropped it in front of us. An 18-foot-long apex predator wanted to share its meal. I've been nipped by an octopus and a sea turtle. Both times were my fault, and watched manta rays relaxing on a reef while smaller fish cleaned the ray's skin. I've seen a humpback calf lying across its mom's head while she lifted it above the surface to breathe and then brought it back down, teaching it how to function in its world. My hope is that by showing visitors these animals up close, they'll understand how precious and vulnerable they are. This underwater sculpture park was created in 2006 by an artist who hoped to divert tourists from a nearby reef that had been damaged by divers touching and even breaking off pieces of coral. The statues are life-size depictions of 26 local children, and they've been colonized by multiple types of corals, big lacy fans and stony polyps, all tended to by the fish. Being down there reminds me that I'm part of the food chain of a water colony, not superior to any other living being. Seeing the statues holding hands and the marine life making a home among them sends a beautiful message that working together is the only way for all of us to thrive. And now, let's move to the Feeling Good section of the magazine with the reminder that February is National Heart Month. The heart is a lady part. Simply being female can increase your risk of cardiovascular issues. Here's what you need to know. Women's health encompasses more than just your ovaries, uterus, and breasts. It includes taking care of your heart, too. That's because estrogen, the female sex hormone, has a thorny relationship with the organ. While it can be helpful by increasing levels of protective HDL cholesterol, keeping bad LDL in check, and relaxing veins and arteries to ease blood flow, supplemental estrogen can also make some women vulnerable to stroke or heart disease. What's more, pregnancy and other conditions that affect only women can have a profound effect on your ticker. It's time to have a heart-to-heart with your OBGYN, keeping in mind the following facts about the cardio connection. The pill is safer than it used to be, but not for everyone. Newer formulations of the pill contain much lower doses of estrogen, and the latest data show that low-dose birth control only slightly boosts the odds of ischemic stroke, caused by blood clots among women without stroke risk factors. However, says OBGYN Catherine Economy, MD, co-director of the Center for Cardiovascular Disease and Pregnancy at Boston's Brigham and Young's Hospital, quote, some medical conditions do rule out taking estrogen-containing contraceptives, end of quote, including a history of breast cancer, liver tumors, or cardiovascular disease, migraines with auras, or being a smoker over 35. She goes on to say, quote, still an enormous number of women can take the pill safely, end of quote. Protect yourself. If you're not a candidate for the Progestin Plus estrogen pill, there are other options. IUDs, progestin-only, Mirena or hormone-free Paragard, and progestin injections or implants. Ask your OBGYN what's best for you. PCOS raises the risk of heart disease. Polycystic ovary syndrome, PCOS, is a hormonal disorder infamous for impairing fertility, but it also makes women more susceptible to heart disease and stroke risk factors. These include high blood pressure and high LDL cholesterol, as well as diabetes, which increases the chance of dying of heart disease 2- to 4-fold. More than 50% of women with PCOS develop type 2 diabetes by age 40, according to the CDC. Protect yourself. Talk to your doctor or OBGYN if you have PCOS symptoms like severe acne, irregular periods, trouble getting pregnant, or weight gain. If you're diagnosed, you'll also want to be monitored for type 2 diabetes and its accompanying heart risks. Pregnancy-related issues don't end after delivery. In a study of nearly 4,700 mothers, those who had gestational diabetes were more than 3 times as likely to have developed pre-diabetes or type 2 diabetes 11 years later, compared with mothers who didn't have gestational diabetes. And women who had hypertension while pregnant were twice as likely to develop high blood pressure even 20 or more years postpartum, per research published in the journal BMJ. Dr. Economy says, quote, pregnancy isn't just a stress on the body. It unmasks underlying predispositions to vascular or metabolic problems, end of quote. Protect yourself. Inform your GP of all pregnancy complications, even if you had your last child more than a decade ago. Request a plan for testing your blood pressure, blood sugar, and cholesterol to monitor for prediabetes and heart disease risk. Hormone replacement therapy, HRT, may not help but could hurt your heart. Women are more likely to have a heart attack about 10 years after menopause than in the years prior, partly because of the drop in protective estrogen levels. Clinicians once believed that HRT could protect against cardiac issues while also treating menopausal symptoms, but after large trials tied HRT to increased risks of stroke and heart attack, as well as breast cancer, doctors stopped prescribing it as a preventative measure. Protect yourself. This doesn't mean you can't consider HRT to treat miserable menopausal symptoms, though it's not generally advised for women with risk factors that include a history of stroke, breast or endometrial cancers, blood clots, or liver disease. Recent research indicates timing is key. Taking HRT for a short period of time, no more than 5 years, during perimenopause or soon after menopause should pose minimal risk for most women, but your doctor can help you assess whether it's right for you, says Jennifer Mears, MD, professor of cardiology at the Zucker School of Medicine at Hofstra Northwell. Menopause, the point at which you haven't menstruated in a year, occurs on average at age 51. Early menopause is linked to cardiovascular disease. This may be in part because after menopause, your body is less able to regulate blood pressure. The earlier you make that shift, the longer your heart is vulnerable. Protect yourself. If your period stopped before age 45, get a heart disease risk assessment. This can be done by a cardiologist or your OBGYN, says Mieres, since both understand the special needs of a woman's heart. And now, here's an article entitled Breast Test Stress. If it seems like everybody's giving different advice about when to be screened for breast cancer, that's because they are. Let's sort it out. Confused about mammograms? You're not alone. Three major medical groups disagree on screening recommendations for women at average risk. The American College of Radiology advises starting yearly mammograms at age 40. The American Cancer Society agrees about yearlies but says they should start at 45 and can switch to every other year at 55. And the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force, an independent panel of experts supported by the Department of Health and Human Services, recommends every other year from ages 50 to 74. The reason for these discrepancies? Organizations give different weight to the potential benefits of screening, namely finding cancer earlier and thus lowering the chance of dying from it, versus its potential harms, like anxiety and unnecessary treatment due to false positives and the discovery of slow-moving cancers that would never actually cause problems. Complicating matters, since older women are more likely to get cancer, they benefit more from screening, but mammograms do save the lives of a small number of younger women. So how to proceed? Start by following the advice all experts agree on. Know your breasts. If you see or feel a new lump or pucker, consult a doctor. Talk with every new OBGYN or primary care provider about your risk, beginning in your 20s. The guidelines for that conversation are, and there are about 5 points here. Give as much info as you can about all types of cancer diagnoses on both parents' sides, especially cancers that occurred earlier in life, advises Margaret Flowers, PhD, head of scientific communications at the Breast Cancer Research Fund. Next, if you have a strong family history of breast cancer, inquire about genetic counseling and testing for certain mutations. Next, bring up any of your own past breast issues, including biopsies and exposure to radiation. And then there are two more suggestions. The next one, by age 30, all women should ask their doctor to do a full risk assessment. This is especially important for Ashkenazi Jewish and African American women, since they have a greater likelihood of developing, respectfully, breast cancer or an aggressive cancer. And finally, if you aren't at elevated risk, talk to your doctor about when to begin screening. Regardless of your risk on paper, you still have the right to decide what's best for you. And on the sidebar, Screening Star. Sandra Lee is on a mission to help everyone get tested for cancer. Anybody who's ever had a mammogram knows there's no day at the beach. So it's ironic that some women have to use vacation time to get one, or at a minimum miss a few hours of work. But the situation has recently improved, for New Yorkers at least. A new law requires the state's 210 hospital-based mammography facilities to offer screening hours either before or after the workday or on weekends, and bans insurance companies from charging annual deductibles, copays, or coinsurance payments for in-network screening mammograms. The law also eliminates those fees for medically necessary imaging, like diagnostic mammograms, ultrasounds, and MRIs. When announcing the bill in 2016, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo invoked his partner, the home life expert and philanthropist Sandra Lee, who'd been diagnosed with ductal carcinoma in situ, or non-invasive breast cancer, and chose to have a double mastectomy. Cuomo said she was lucky to have caught it early. By expanding screening hours and removing insurance barriers, this agreement will give our wives, daughters, and sisters better access to life-saving health services so they, too, can get ahead of this disease. Since her diagnosis, Lee has become so passionate about the power of screening that she co-executive produced an HBO documentary short, RX, Early Detection, A Cancer Journey, with Sandra Lee. She hopes all states will take New York's cue and guarantee the same provisions and eventually include other screenings as well. In Lee's view, mammograms are just the beginning. She says, quote, early detection is important for every type of cancer, end of quote. And the next article is called Finish Strong. To get the most out of your workout, you need to train yourself to chill. Christy Oswaden, author of Good to Go, What the Athlete in All of Us Can Learn from the Strange Science of Recovery, explains how to rest the right way. No pain, no gain. Go hard or go home. That's what we hear in CrossFit, in spin class, and even from some yoga instructors. But while it's true that pushing yourself can pay off, so does giving yourself a break. In fact, as a trail runner and cyclist, I've come to think of recovery less as something that happens after a workout and more as the final part of the workout itself. It's like flowing through when you hit a tennis ball. You get the most out of your efforts when you complete the motion and slow down gradually. Here's how to reap the rewards of any sweat session. Rule 1. Refuel with real food. Even if you exercise specifically to burn calories, you still need to refill your energy stores because protein is essential in repairing and building muscle, and carbs help replenish the glucose or glycogen you used for fuel. So here's what you do. After you've cooled down, eat some yogurt or a banana with peanut butter. If it's mealtime, make it a balanced one. Experts used to think there was a post-exercise recovery window of 30 to 45 minutes within which you had to eat to build strength. But research has since shown that if you won't be working out again in a few hours, you actually have plenty of time to refuel. Don't bother with special energy foods or supplements. Unless you've been sweating and panting intensely for several hours, you could end up consuming many more calories than you burned. Rule number 2, heal thyself. The intense aches that arise a day or two after a workout are symptoms of delayed onset muscle soreness, and they're the normal result of straining your muscles enough to develop micro tears. To fix the damage, your body activates an inflammatory response, which causes the muscles to grow back strong enough to handle the next bout of exertion with less discomfort. Do keep moving. The only proven antidote to delayed onset muscle soreness is time, usually 3 to 4 days. Don't bother with products promising to flush out lactic acid. That's not what makes you sore. And anyway, your muscles naturally clear the acid in about an hour, says Michael Joyner, MD, an exercise scientist at the Mayo Clinic. As for ice baths and potions intended to reduce inflammation, neither has been proven to alleviate soreness. Ibuprofen can reduce discomfort, but might also delay healing. Rule 3, prioritize sleep. Getting your Z's is like dropping yourself off at the repair shop. As you slumber, your body releases testosterone and growth hormones that speed tissue repair and aid in muscle building. Do clock at least 7 hours of quality sleep every day. Don't bother with fixating on sleep data from watches, fitness trackers, or apps. These measurements are much cruder than those you'd get in a sleep lab, and one study found that they could be off by as much as an hour, says Amy Bender, PhD, a senior research scientist at Calgary Counseling Center. An alarm reminding you to head to bed is as high-tech as you need to get. Rule number 4, treat yourself well. Practice what feels good to your body, paying special attention to the muscles you recently worked. Do pamper yourself with some R&R, meditation, massage, a warm bath, even a comfy yoga pose. They're all effective ways to relax body and mind. Don't bother with anything that feels like an obligation. After trying countless tools, practices, apps, supplements, classes, and therapies, I've come to understand that the key to optimal recovery isn't forcing yourself to do rituals you loathe. Goodbye, foam roller. Hello, massage. The best method is the one that you enjoy. As we wrap up this installment, let's look at some items from the O-List Valentine's Day edition. And on the very first page, against this white background, we have floating three pairs of heart-shaped earrings in red, gold, and hot pink. And they're made out of a small cord, and the cord's been wrapped around like a sphere, a small ball, and that goes like in a post in the ear, and then dangling underneath that is a flat heart, and the same little cord has been laid out and kind of zigzagged back and forth in a heart-shaped pattern. It takes two to dangle. These earrings are handmade in Morocco, but you can mo-rock them anywhere, from a date night dinner to takeout and House Hunters reruns with your beloved. Either way, make sure you post a lot of selfies. Cora Hart earrings, $250 per pair, at RebeccaDeRavenel.com. And now here's a bundt cake in the shape of a heart with dusty confectioner sugar on top. Bubble bundt. Somehow the virtuosos at PM Delights baked the delicate deliciousness of strawberries and champagne right into this lush cake, saving you all the rinsing and potential injury via popped cork projectiles. A slice or three is just as intoxicating as a flute of fizz. Champagne Strawberry Heart Cake, originally $68, now 20% off with code OPRAH, pmdelights.com. There's a white sweater with a stand-up collar and four brass buttons that come down the mock turtle and the shoulder. So this is winter white, and a great big red heart has been woven into the front. The cozy cream-colored charmer with nautical brass buttons will make you even more huggable than you already are. Kate Spade, New York, Heart Turtleneck Sweater, $278 at katespade.com. It wouldn't be Valentine's Day without chocolate. And from LyraChocolatius.com, we have chocolate bars with freeze-dried fruit on them. They're originally $15 each, now 20% off with code OPRAH. We've run out of time for today's episode of OPRAH Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Susan Dellinger, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.